Welcome to Missouri Athletic Club Connections, a podcast highlighting the foremost private club in St. Louis, known for attracting exceptional people and enriching lives for generations. I'm Monica Ryan, MAC Communication Strategist. On this very special episode, we take you inside the Missouri Room on April 17th for the USBWA College Basketball Awards with featured speaker, legendary coach, Roy Williams.
Good evening and welcome to Missouri Athletic Club for the U.S. Basketball Writers Association's 2024 Awards Banquet. My name is Aaron Paulitson. I serve on the Planning Committee. I'm going to extend a few well-deserved thank yous, make one introduction, give a little bit of reflection, and then we're going to get right into the program. In 2018, one gentleman was primarily responsible for connecting USBWA and Missouri Athletic Club so that we could, from that point forward, be the host for this event. We members of the club are very grateful to him. He served in college athletics for more than 50 years, highlighted by serving as Associate Commissioner of the Missouri Valley Conference, and starting in 1983 through his retirement in 2019, he served as U.S. Basketball Writers Association's longest tenured executive director. He's not able to join us here tonight, but it's a name I want you to know. His name is Mr. Joe Mitch, and we're grateful for all his work. Our deep gratitude also extends to those businesses and individuals who sponsored the awards banquet. Without their investment in this opportunity to celebrate college basketball, the club would not be able to fuel such a powerful experience. The names of the event's sponsors and underwriters are set forth in your written program, and they appear on the screens around the room throughout the night. We're grateful for the dozens of participating sponsors, many of whom have sponsored since 2018. Special recognition is due for the leading generosity of Eddie, Pat, and Jason, from our presenting sponsors, AJ Gallagher and Renaissance Financial. To every single one of you who underwrote the VIP luncheon, underwrote this dinner, or were a participating sponsor or a presenting sponsor, stand up now so we can recognize and thank you. We have tremendous support for this awards banquet. To our award winners and featured guests, we appreciate that you took the time and effort to travel here and join us. Coach Williams, Coach Staley, Coach Sampson, Coach Oriyama, Ms. Watkins, Mr. Shepherd, and Coach Henson. We appreciate you being here. Thank you so very much. The club's relationship with USBWA is special. USBWA's relationship with women's and men's college basketball is special. Please join me in welcoming to the mic Malcolm Moran of the U.S. Basketball Writers Association.
Thanks, Aaron. Good evening, everybody. And thanks to all of you for being here tonight for an annual celebration of the best of the game that has become a true highlight of the college basketball calendar because of the months of planning, hospitality, and attention to detail that always goes into it. So thank you from all of us. On behalf of the 800 women and men of the United States Basketball Writers Association, Thanks and congratulations to all of our honorees at the end of an historic season. To Caitlin and Zach, whose achievements created connections over the decades to some of the greats of the game and will one day connect them to players that are not yet born. To Juju and Reed for your remarkable transition to a new level of play, new surroundings, new everything, and for making it all look so easy when we all know it wasn't. To Dawn and Kelvin, not just for your success this season, but for the way your teams played the game and the standards that they set. And Kelvin, when we pointed out your record 29-year span between Henry Ibo Awards, sorry for failing to mention how very, very young you were the first time you won it. And to Roy and Gino for bringing the history of the game to us tonight. Maybe we'll get to hear that 19 years after a memorable celebration in this town, Roy might just take a walk down to the banks of the Mississippi to deposit one more souvenir for old time's sake. And Gino, thanks for calling back again and for sharing a special moment when you learned why we were hoping you could make it here tonight. There's been no shortage of history made in Storrs, Connecticut in the last 39 years. Thanks for being here to make a little more tonight. And, spoiler alert, writers being writers, please don't be surprised if there's a surprise before we're done. Aaron, I'll say this affectionately and with gratitude because we're talking about one of my favorites. But now that Bill Walton has wrapped up his remarks from last year's dinner, pull up a chair and enjoy an evening with the best of the game. And thanks to everyone for making this happen.
The first Bill Walton joke of the night. It's great to have you here tonight, Malcolm. Do all of you recall your first intersection with college basketball? Do you remember your first memory about it? Mine was watching the 85 Final Four, Villanova, Georgetown. My father, sitting over there, didn't let me stay up and watch the title game, so of course I assumed Georgetown won and was shocked at breakfast the next morning. My first memory of phenomenal women's play was Rebecca Lobo, 94-95 Huskies. It was phenomenal to see her also be named and be recognized USBWA's Women's Player of the Year that year. No matter what your first intersection with college basketball might have been, I doubt that the memories of this most recent season will fade anytime soon. It provided us another opportunity to connect with our friends, with our parents, with our sons, with our daughters, on cold nights to watch some hoops. Not a bad way to spend a winter. Now, before we get going, I'm gonna hand out three assignments for the evening. First and foremost, whenever we have an award winner or an honoree come to this platform, I want you to give them an ovation so loud that it can be heard in West Lafayette and Iowa City. Second, if you see our dear friend Michelle Smallman from ESPN milling about the room, give her a bit of emotional space. She's still getting over her Fighting Illini going on a cold streak in the middle of an Elite Eight game. You brought it up on the air. I wouldn't have gone there otherwise. And finally, we thought about giving this man the night off after he earned combat duty pay last year while navigating interview with 2023 featured guest Hall of Famer Bill Walton. But he insisted on returning so he can actually get a full question out of his mouth. Join me in welcoming our MC for the night, KMOX Sports Director, Tom Ackerman.
Thank you, Aaron. Appreciate you. Aaron, thank you very much. Yeah, how's that sound? A nice, tight broadcast and show tonight. Looking forward to that. My first game, North Carolina, Georgetown. I bet my dad a dollar that the Tar Heels would take him down, and Michael Jordan got the job done. I won. I got that gambling scandal now hanging over me. Ladies and gentlemen, it is great to be here. This is the heartbeat of sports in America, St. Louis, Missouri. We are thrilled to have the USBWA College Basketball Awards in our town. Let's hear it for the USBWA. Great to have just the giants of the game with us here today. We're going to have some unbelievable names, guests, honorees, and people that I know you're going to be thrilled to see. And we are very excited to bring it to you. We want to go around the room and let you know, though, that there are many, many great college basketball luminaries and dignitaries in our crowd here today. College basketball fans throughout. Let's start with, at table 23, St. Charles County Executive Steve Ellman is here. Table 23, the head coach at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, Bob Sundvold. Table 15, head coach at Central Methodist University, Matt Sherman. Table 27, former governor and attorney general of the state of Missouri, Governor Jay Nixon. From SIU Edwardsville, please welcome their athletic director, Andrew Gavin. And head basketball coach, Brian Baroni. At the Lewis Rice table, we have University of Illinois Athletics Chief Operating Officer, Roger Denny. The St. Louis Sports Commission, boy, do they do a job. They play a key role in bringing many great college events to our town, including NCAA basketball tournament action. We can't thank them enough. Please welcome their president, Mark Schreiber. Speaking of the NCAA tournament, what a job they do. The Missouri Valley Conference, they host an exciting conference tournament here in St. Louis. They also do a wonderful job with NCAA tournament events here in St. Louis. The league is headquartered here. How about a nice welcome for their commissioner, Jeff Jackson? And associate commissioner, Jack Watkins. The next person we want to recognize, a McDonald's All-American in 1995, went on to play at the University of Kansas. He played for tonight's featured guest, Roy Williams. Please welcome Ryan Robertson. Ladies and gentlemen, earlier this year, Caitlin Clark set the major college women's career scoring mark. And right here in St. Louis, we had our own scoring machine. She made national headlines, University of Health Sciences and Pharmacy. She set a women's NAIA career scoring record with an amazing 3,961 points. Please welcome Grace Beyer. St. Louis University is here, ladies and gentlemen. Their athletic director, Chris May. He has had some exciting things going on, hasn't he? The basketball coach, he was here a little earlier today. He's got some business to attend to. Very busy time for him right now. The mid-major coach of the year, Josh Schertz. He was at our pre-event reception upstairs, and the women's team is represented well here today, capturing their first WNIT championship in school history the year after the first NCAA tournament appearance in school history. Please welcome their coach, Rebecca Tillett. And folks, we also want to welcome some proud parents who are here to travel to be with us tonight and share in this special evening. The parents of the Women's Freshman of the Year, Juju Watkins. They came in from Los Angeles to be here tonight. Please give a nice welcome, Sari and Bobby. And the parents of the Men's Freshman of the Year, Reed Shepherd. They were each basketball standouts at UK, and now their son is carrying on the tradition.
Please welcome Stacy and Jeff Shepherd. And now, folks, it is my honor and MAC staff, if we could bring two microphones to the stage that we can grab and make sure that there they are. Thank you very much. Look how easy that was. It is my pleasure. In fact, you know what? Let me give him the proper introduction because he deserves it. You know him well as the former head coach at Missouri State, Southern Illinois. He's made some great appearances through the years at KU, as well as the associate athletic director currently at Oklahoma State University. Please welcome our friend Barry Henson.
Are we sitting down? Yeah. Okay.
Barry, come have a seat. How are you, buddy? Barry Henson, ladies and gentlemen. How awesome. I'll tell you what, it is good to have you back.
Let me ask you a question real quick before we get started. Grace broke the all-time scoring record ever, and she went to a pharmacy school? Okay.
Missed opportunity?
No, I'm just telling you, they're not drug testing over there. Grace, you'd have no clue how many women are going to come see you tonight after this event. Congratulations, and I'll also come see you right after we get through.
Barry, how good is it to be back?
I'm home. It's great. I got up this morning at 4 o'clock. You know people go to work at 4 o'clock in the morning? Who are those people? It's like a scene from Wedding Crashers. Meatloaf. Mom. What is she doing? I never know what she's doing. What were those people doing at 4:30 this morning? I was the 20th car in a stoplight. 20th at 4:30 in the morning. Were they making donuts? What are they doing? But I got here, and then it didn't take me long. I got in trouble right off the bat. I signed in for breakfast. Is Ricky, you in here? Ricky busted my ass because I told the lady I was Roy Williams. And then and then Ricky comes in and says, "Hey, Coach Henson." I didn't have, that was, you know. And then tonight, right? God dang it, I used the wrong fork. Oh, I hate that deal. When you got all the forks and knives, the guy said, "Sir, this is not the knife. You need to keep this knife." He busted you too. You didn't even acknowledge it.
Yeah, I got in trouble.
It's been good. I'm home, and I'm glad to be here. I'm just glad that we don't have therapy couches like we did 2 years ago when I was here. And I'm really glad that I'm here tonight because from what I heard last year, Bill Walton's getting ready to whoop your ass.
He was fine. He closed down the Jack Buck Grill, I heard. Is that right? Barry, you are home. Missouri Sports Hall of Famer right here, Barry Henson.
I tell you what was special about being inducted into the Hall of Fame. My first call was to Bill Self, and I said, "I've done something that you will never, ever do."
The former KU coach, Roy Williams, is here. We had some incredible coaches upstairs for our reception. Let's start with Kelvin Sampson at the University of Houston. He is being honored tonight, Men's Basketball Coach of the Year.
Well, I've known Coach Sampson for a long time, and early in my career, Coach Sampson was just, he was mean. He just looked mean. He acted mean. He was tough. And then he had grandkids. And now he's just faking it. But I'll never forget, I was a young coach at Oral Roberts University, and that's back when they paid a lot of money for a bye game. They paid us, I think, $10,000 and 4 boxes of pizza. But we went down to Norman, and we had a racquetball court at ORU that we would prepare. You know, sometimes we'd just do different drills and stuff. And I told the assistant coaches, you know, we're getting ready to play Oklahoma, and those guys are, hell, they just guard their ass off. We got to be tough. So I told my assistant coach, run down to the dog shelter and bring me back 4 of the meanest dogs you can find. And then we put a shot clock outside the racquetball court. and we wiped peanut butter all over their arms. And I got a pit bull, a chihuahua, a Doberman pincher, and a basset hound. The basset hound wasn't mean, but he had a lip that went up, looked like he's growling, and my sister just thought he was a badass basset hound. But anyway, put peanut butter on him, and we just started. 35 seconds, go in there, and 35 seconds, and get out of there, and let's go. It didn't work. It was a hell of a drill, and we were great for the peanut butter economy, but they kicked our ass. From that point on, we just threw goldfish into the cold tub and told them they were baby piranhas.
The undefeated South Carolina Gamecocks and the Women's National Coach of the Year, Dawn Staley.
It's a true story now. I went over and talked to her. I told her what I was going to say. My wife loves Coach Staley, loves her. And every time they play, we watch her, and she's got that stare. She's a lot like my mom. I think if she coached me, she would have used all three names. Did your mom ever use all three names?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a good thing, was it?
No.
And Coach Staley's just, she's got that look. And then when we're watching her games, I don't know what it is, but if one of her girls turns it over or whatever, I just get up and start cleaning the house. extremely intimidating. I will say this. We got writers here tonight, right? They're here? Yeah, okay. I'm gonna. You know what clickbait is? You ever done clickbait?
I know clickbait, yeah.
Okay, I do it all the time. And by the way, that bank up there that was one of our sponsors, it's not 10.7% for checking interest. That's clickbait. But anyway. One of the things with Coach Staley, and I believe this, and I'm going to say this in all seriousness. If there were ever someone to cross over and coach men's, I think she could be the first one to do it and do a great job of it. And I'm associate AD. I'm not a head AD yet. No, I'll never be. There's no way they'll ever get me be the AD. But if I were Coach Staley, I'd hire you just right off the bat. Just tell you right now. And I really enjoy watching her play. And my house was really clean today, Coach, when I left.
Well, it was unbelievable buzz to have her in the building, as well as this man, the 11-time national champion and Hall of Famer, Gino Auriemma, is here.
I'd never met Coach until tonight. I knew all about him because Andrew Hootie was our strength coach at Kansas, which is now his strength coach, and had come from UConn and now is back with Coach. But Coach's son has worked our KU camps, and I have nothing but the utmost respect for him. There's two people in this room tonight that have meant a lot to women's basketball, and you are seeing the fruits of their labors go into effect right now with what's going on. And I think it's one of the greatest things that I've ever witnessed as a father of two daughters and a granddaughter that just keeps saying every time she sees Caitlin Clark, she says, "Let's freaking go." Because my daughter was smart enough to tell her what she was really saying.
And as a girls basketball coach, it has been some of the greatest years of my life. Thank you, coaches, very much. Let's hear it for Coaches Staley and Auriemma. And Roy Williams is in the house. Roy Williams, 3-time national champion.
There it is. I told you. I knew it was going to happen. Now, I taught at Catholic Church for 6 years, Catholic schools. And you know what it takes to see a miracle. The former head coach at the University of Kansas just got a round of applause in Missouri. You have just witnessed. You may live all your life and never witness a miracle, but you just did. I got a Roy Williams story. Can I tell it?
Yeah, yeah, please.
We got time?
Yes.
We're not 52 minutes, y'all, are we?
No, you're not in Walton territory okay. yet. Go ahead.
Coach doesn't know this story. It's a great story. One of my very best friends, Joe Holiday, was with Coach Williams. We're getting ready to play Mizzou. I'm the head coach at Oral Roberts University. This is before we have email. This is before we have fax machines. And the Antlers start faxing me 2 days prior to our game. You need to go to the prayer tower. There's not enough spirit. You know, whatever. You're going to need more prayer. And then we show up for the game. And all these guys are dressed in priest outfits. Priest outfits. The Antlers, they're not real smart. I mean, we're a Pentecostal school. But anyway, there are all these deals. And so I called Joe prior to the game. Now this, you got to remember that you have, Bob knows, but you have all these press notes that you get. They're emailed to you now, and you know what's going on. And we walk into the gym, and it says, I go into the media room like I always do, get the press notes, I see them, and it says, Norm Stewart goes for 700th win this evening. Seriously. Kyle. I mean, I'm just ridiculous. 701, we had no chance. But anyway, I called Joe Holiday, and I said, you got any advice for coaching against Mizzou and Coach Stewart? And he said, yeah, I'll tell you right now. Don't ever, ever look down at Norm Stewart. Don't do it. He said, I've told Coach this, and you look down there, and Coach Stewart, Coach, you'll have to say if it's true or not, but Joe told me, Coach Stewart would look at Coach Williams and go. And Joe said he couldn't coach the game, so he's so mad at Coach. So I'm coaching a game like this. I got my good friend Kim Anser down there. I won't even look down there. But I did that, and then I will say this. I met Coach as a high school coach. I got to work his camps, and lucky for me, Scotty Williams, his son, was in part of that. Bob Frederick's son was there, Brad, and it started a relationship. And I've had three references in my lifetime, three on my resume. My wife, thank God they never call her, and Coach Williams and Bill Self. And Coach has always been good to me, and I respect him tremendously.
We'll hear from the coaches. We'll hear from the coaches in just a bit. We can't wait. Before we go, let's get real here. Let's talk about the biggest star of the night, and that is your wife, Angie. How's she doing?
I asked her if she wanted to come because I told her Jim had offered to fly her in, and she goes, hell no. But we're going on 43 in August. Yeah. Yeah, you can clap, but those odds, 5-1 odds out of Vegas that one of us is going to be on Dateline or 48 Hours.
Ladies and gentlemen, Barry Henson.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Let's introduce now, please welcome to the podium, what an incredible career trajectory she is on, from Belleville, Illinois, national radio host, ESPN Radio, Michelle Smallman.
Thank you, Tom. I am Michelle Smallman, and even though I work at ESPN nationally now, St. Louis is home, and I am so thrilled to be back home and be here at the Missouri Athletic Club for this amazing event. And as Aaron mentioned, I am also a proud graduate of the University of Illinois, still processing what happened to us in the Elite Eight. Pretty tough. Well, one person this year skyrocketed to superstardom. I don't think there's a person in America that doesn't know her name. From being on SNL to being drafted number one overall in the WNBA and having her jersey sell out in just an hour, Caitlin Clark has been transformational on and off the court. She is the National Women's Player of the Year. She is the recipient of the Ann Myers Drysdale Award. And if I was going to read all of her accomplishments and stats from this season, we'd be here all night. But here are just a few. She became the NCAA's all-time leading scorer during the season. She's the first Division I women's basketball player to eclipse 1,000 points in back-to-back seasons. She's the first D1 player to record 3,800 plus points, 1,000 plus assists, and 950 plus rebounds in a career. Her amazing career is just getting started. It was a highlight-filled season, and let's take a look at some of the amazing moments this year from Caitlin Clark.
And ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to present the award for the Oscar Robertson Trophy as Men's Basketball Player of the Year, maintaining his dominance in the paint, averaging 24.6 points per game, and second in rebounding at 12.1 per game. Those marks helped lead the Purdue Boilermakers to the national championship game, a Big Ten regular season title before that, their first Final Four since 1980. He is the first repeat winner of the Oscar Robertson Trophy since Ralph Sampson in the early 1980s, and the first to win it at Purdue since Glenn Robinson. Let's hear it for Zach Edey.
One more time for Caitlin Clark and Zach Edey. Incredible seasons for both of them. And we have another player in the house who had an absolutely remarkable season. It is my honor to introduce the Freshman of the Year Award winner, Juju Watkins. Who's here? Yes. She is the recipient of the Tamika Catchings Award tonight. She came into USC as one of the nation's top recruits, a lot of fanfare surrounding her entrance into the collegiate ranks, and she did not disappoint at all. She set a school record, for men and women, 13 games of 30 or more points. She's the USBWA's National Freshman Player of the Year. I've been up since 2:45 this morning, guys. Bear with me. But she was the USBWA's National Freshman Player of the Week three times this season and the USBWA's Freshman of the Year. Let's look at some of the incredible highlights from Juju Watkins' season.
Thank you.
a shooting star. She's your freshman player of the year. Give it up for Juju Watkins. Juju, it's such a pleasure to have you here tonight and to be able to speak with you. And as I mentioned in the open, you came to USC with a lot of expectations, a lot of fanfare surrounding your arrival. You met those, certainly exceeded those, but was there any pressure on you to have a certain amount of success right out of the gate at USC?
Not really. I think the pressure was really on myself, like me having my own goals for myself. But I would say my family and my team and my coaches really helped me with just staying calm and present in the moment.
As we just saw in the highlight video there, you had so many incredible accomplishments this season. Is there one thing that sticks out to you that you're the most proud of?
Yeah, a Pac-12 championship, the last ever with my team. I think that was really special.
That is really special. What an incredible accomplishment. As you were growing up, is there someone that you really admired or someone that you modeled your game after?
Yeah, Candace Parker. She was my GOAT growing up. She was at the Sparks when I was growing up as an LA kid, so I always caught a game when I could.
Have you met her yet?
Yes.
How was that?
It's amazing. Yeah, she's still starstruck every time I see her, so.
I can only imagine. So as we mentioned, you had an incredible season, a lot of momentum that you build up at USC. How do you carry that over into next season?
Yeah, I think just getting in the gym constantly, getting better as much as I can. I think that's what keeps me going, I guess.
So you're a freshman, or you were a freshman, obviously. So every experience was new to you, but women's basketball exploded this year in an incredible way. What was it like for you to step into this world with so many eyeballs on your sport?
Yeah, I mean, it's an honor. I mean, rightfully so. I think we deserve all the attention and even more. We put in the work. We're exciting to watch, so I'm just glad to be a part of such a great group of girls.
And it's a sisterhood, right?
Yes.
Anyone that I speak to within the women's game really highlights how much of a sisterhood it is.
Yeah, I mean, we're all striving for the same thing, just growing the game.
So as there were so many eyes that were being pulled onto women's basketball this season, and simultaneously you were having this incredible freshman year, was there one moment to you that was like, wow, I can't believe that this is happening?
I'm not sure. I think just being a freshman, I get that moment a lot, so I don't know.
Yeah, everything is new and wow when you're a freshman, right? Well, after you accomplished so much this season, I'm sure you checked some things off your list of goals. What's on your list of goals moving forward?
I think a championship is always on there, so that's the goal.
And I'm sure as an incredible competitor, getting to the tournament, advancing to a certain point, not enough for you. That's what you want next year, right?
Yes.
And what did you learn this year in the tournament?
Well, my first tournament run, I think just embracing all the nerves. I was really nervous going into it, just the platform and everything. It was very nerve-wracking. So now that I know what to expect, I can calm myself down a little more.
Well, we never would have noticed that there were any nerves at all. You were cool as a cucumber. What an incredible season for Juju Watkins. Give it up for our freshman of the year, everybody. Thank you.
Juju, congratulations, and thank you so much for being here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, the Wayman Tisdale Award is given out to the men's freshman of the year. From the University of Kentucky, they have had two winners of this award, Anthony Davis and John Wall. The SEC has had multiple winners of this award through the years. But this freshman did a couple of things that no Kentucky player has ever done. Not freshman, no Kentucky player has ever done. One of them, first Kentucky player in school history to have three games with at least 25 points, at least 5 rebounds, and at least 5 assists in a single season. Think about that for a moment. The first player in Kentucky history to register 5 steals in three consecutive games, and he did them all against SEC competition, Ole Miss, Auburn, and LSU. Oh, by the way, he shoots the lights out. He led the country in three-point shooting, 52.6% from three. He is the third Wildcat to win the award, but as you can tell, he is the first in many categories in one of the great college programs in America. Let's take a look. Ladies and gentlemen, the Wayman Tisdale Award, Men's Freshman of the Year, Reed Shepherd. Reed, congratulations. When you see those highlights, first of all, you saw the highlights from the hump. The hump is Humphrey, that's at Mississippi State. You had 32 points. I think you lit him up for 23 in the second half. Playing on the road in the SEC and getting the job done like that. Let's talk about that game specifically in late February. What do you remember from that?
Yeah, it was a great game. You know, all SEC games are really tough, especially on the road. When you're Kentucky, everyone is going to play the best game against you. So it was a really fun game. It was sold out, and you know we struggled the first half. It wasn't our best half, and the coaches, my coaches and my teammates, they kept telling me, like, Reed, you got to shoot the ball, you got to play, we need you to play. And in the second half, you know, I came out and I started shooting the ball, and my teammates kept instilling confidence in me, and the coaches were like, Reed, you got to shoot, we know what you can do. So all that whole game, the game winner, all that's just straight on my coaches and teammates for just the whole game giving me confidence to go out there and do it.
You made a great point just now also in that every game that Kentucky plays is a huge game for the other team, especially when they're on the road. What is that like? How does your group prepare itself for those type of atmospheres?
Yeah, you get used to it after a while, but it's tough. You know, we were a young team, and Coach Cal and all the coaches did a really good job of preparing us. You know, when you play Kentucky, it's everyone's Super Bowl. So you got to play every game like it's the national championship, and you got to come out every game and be prepared. It doesn't matter what team it is, who you're playing, where it is. You have to come out with the same amount of energy and effort every game.
And, you know, a team like Tennessee obviously wants to beat you. Meanwhile, they're the fourth-ranked team in the country. When you played them, you won there in Knoxville. You had another great game there. What do you remember from that game at Tennessee?
Yeah, that game to me was special. You know, I'm from Kentucky. You know, it was a dream of mine to play at the University of Kentucky, and I didn't like Tennessee. You know, I don't think any Kentucky fan likes Tennessee. So being able to go to Tennessee, and they just beat us at home. So everyone that game, we were ready to get back, and we were all excited. We were pumped. We were going into their place. You know, they had just beat us, so we were all excited. And it was a really fun game. You know, we came out, we were hitting shots, and we were rolling, and they went on their little run, and it was back and forth the whole game. Crowd was into it. And then at the end, you know, we hit a few shots, and then they got back into it. But we came out with the win. But all around, it was a really fun game, and it was one of the most fun games all year.
Reed, I mentioned that your parents are here. Tell me about them, but specifically what they have meant to you in your basketball life, getting you ready for this moment.
Yeah, my mom and dad mean the world to me. You know, growing up, there was nothing Kentucky in the house. There was nothing of their, no jerseys, no accomplishments. They didn't want to be known as the basketball players. They wanted to be known as mom and dad. And to me, that was really special. I mean, it was until middle school that I finally realized like why everyone would come up and take pictures with mom and dad, and everywhere we would go out, he used to get mad because people would come up and take pictures, and I'd be like, Dad, who is that? And he couldn't tell me. He didn't know who it was, but they were just fans, and I didn't know that. And that's what I appreciate most about them is just how good of people they are and how much respect they have off the court from everyone just because of how they are as people. They treat everyone with class, and that's what I've learned the most from them is just treat others the way you want to be treated, and just I've been very thankful to have them as my parents.
Reed, yeah, that's awesome. Last thing. So we talked about being on the road as Kentucky. Tell me what it's like walking through the tunnel at Rupp and playing in front of that crowd.
It's unbelievable. Like I said before, I'm from Kentucky. It was always a dream of mine to play at the University of Kentucky. And being able to do that this year was unbelievable. The team that we had this year was really, really close on and off the court. So we had a really good bond, and it was unbelievable. So being able to put on the Kentucky jersey and run out onto Rupp Arena in front of our crazy fans, in front of our passionate fans, was unbelievable. And having who I think is the best coach in the world, the Hall of Fame coach, it was unbelievable being able to play for him this year, and I'm super happy for him. And just being able to run out on the court in front of the fans at University of Kentucky, with it being a dream of mine ever since I was a little kid, was something I'll never forget. And it was awesome.
You're a lot of fun to watch. Good luck in the next steps in your career. Thank you. Reed Sheppard. Folks, it is my honor at this time to introduce the Henry Iba Award for Coach of the Year. And this coach has actually won this award before. In 1995, as the head coach at the University of Oklahoma. That was his first year, 94-95. Let me give you a list of coaches. John Wooden, Tony Bennett, Fred Taylor, Bob Knight, Ray Meyer, Lou Carnesecca, these are good coaches, Gene Cady, John Chaney, Roy Williams. Kelvin Sampson joins that group as the 10th repeat winner in the 66-year history of the Henry Iba Award. Kelvin Sampson, Coach of the Year, the University of Houston. Let's take a look. Kelvin Sampson, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Man, your teams are always, how do you do it? How do you identify those type of players? Your teams are always tough. Your guards are tough, especially, but you always have an identity. What do you look for in players?
Well, I think it starts with a great staff. I've always been blessed with really good assistant coaches, and there's some great head coaches in this room, and they'll be the first to say that the head coach probably gets a little bit too much credit, probably too much blame too, but certainly too much credit. Since I've been at University of Houston, I've had the same staff for 10 years, and they've had opportunities to go as head coaches, and I've always advised them to do what's best for them and their families, but they've elected to stay, and I think that really does have a lot to do with our success. When I was the head coach at the University of Oklahoma, 2002, we went to the Final Four, and my starting backcourt was Hollis Price and Quantus White, and They're two of my three assistants on the road, the other one being my son, Kellen. So, you know, we have a family atmosphere. They have a clear understanding of what it takes to be successful in our program. We have a really good culture that's been cultivated over time. And we have great kids, and I think that's where it starts.
You told me something upstairs about coaching, and Dawn Staley was up there, and Gino Auriemma, and Roy Williams. You all kind of had the same feel on this, is that you don't need to yell and rant and rave. There is a understanding. There's a trust, I feel like, with all of you, with your players.
Well, as long as you come from the stance that players win games. You know, I was lucky growing up in a household in North Carolina at a really young age with a father that was a Hall of Fame high school coach in North Carolina. He gave me three great pieces of advice. I don't share them a lot, but it's not like he reinvented the wheel. One was that, you know, players win games, coaches lose them. Number two is if you start listening to those people sitting up there behind you, pretty soon you'll be sitting with them. And the third one was don't ever lose sight of the fact that parents would rather their son make the all-conference team than your team win the conference championship. All three of those things have helped me well over the years.
Good pieces of advice right there. What do you remember about, take me all the way back to why you fell in love with basketball. What do you remember about those times?
You know, I was talking to Reed Shepherd and his parents. I'm old. I'm way older than you think. I was born in 1955. So I'm 68. I'll be 69 my next birthday. But in 1965, I was 10 years old, and Pete Maravich went to high school at Raleigh-Broughton High School in Raleigh, North Carolina. But after a senior in high school, he went to Edwards Military Institute before his father took him to LSU. And my dad's high school team was Magnolia High School, which is right outside of Lumberton, North Carolina. And he took his team up to play a doubleheader. My dad's team played, I don't remember who, in the first game. But the second game was Edwards Military Institute. And I saw a guy that looked like the Beatles. Older guys will understand that. He had a Beatles haircut. He looked like Paul and Ringo and rest of those guys that came over from Liverpool back in 64. So, but it's 65. But he was the doggonedest thing I'd ever seen. His socks didn't have any elastic in them. He had Pro Kids. There was no Nikes back then. Steve Prefontaine hadn't been part of American culture yet. But I grew up wanting to be Pete Maravich. And then I wanted to be whoever my father's best players on his teams were. So I think we all have heroes as we grow up. And my heroes happen to be my father's players and Pete Maravich.
That's pretty good. Last thing is, when you look in that huddle and you see those players looking back at you, and you've had some great ones, Coach, I mean, through the years, and you've had some great teams, what do you think about, how do you relate to young people today and to get them to be their best?
Well, don't ever lose sight of why we got into this profession. You know, Gino, Don, Roy, Coach Hertz, all the coaches here tonight. Where we started is not where we are now. We started, my first coaching opportunity, I coached a sixth grade girls team. And the reason we won was because of Sheila Reagan. So Sheila, wherever you are, It's my girl. Sheila Reagan was Caitlin Clark before Caitlin Clark. And our team started winning. I wasn't very smart, but I knew that if we threw the ball to Sheila, she could shoot it in. Those other girls were really good at creating offensive rebounds, which later became important to me. But Sheila Reagan, my girl.
I can relate, coaching seventh grade girls. I got a couple of them. You are one of the greats in the game. And actually, I said it the last thing, but let me put one more thing out there. Is what do you think? Roy said it today upstairs. You hear it all the time. Kelvin Sampson is one of the greatest coaches in the country, bar none. What do you feel when you hear that from people?
Well, I hear it. I'm not sure I listen to it. I think there's a difference in those two. Growing up in North Carolina, when I did, I remember Dean Smith, Coach Smith, would have a blue-white practice in October, and he would have a blue-white game. His North Carolina team would have practice, but they have a blue-white game. And this is how innovative Coach Smith was. This was back in the 60s, early 70s. He would, in North Carolina, he had four state high school athletic classifications, 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A. And I noticed that the guys that spoke at Coach Smith's clinic was the state championship team from 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A. Those were the four speakers. He didn't bring in speakers from other states or other colleges. He had those four high school coaches. I always wanted my father's team to win the state championship because I wanted my dad's team. I wanted my dad to be one of the four speakers. Unfortunately, one of his better players was me, which means he probably was never going to win a state championship. But Coach Smith had a huge influence on all the kids my age that grew up aspiring either to play basketball or maybe one day coaching basketball, and then Coach Knight at Indiana, Coach Wooden at UCLA, Coach Thompson at Georgetown. And believe it or not, one of the guys that I've grown up to really admire, it's really inspired me a lot, was Coach Auriemma at UConn, who I've become good friends with. But he's been an unbelievable inspiration for coaches. You know, sometimes we tend to separate women's coaches and men's coaches. There's no such thing in our profession. They're coaches. You know, Coach Staley, Coach Auriemma, they would be successful no matter who they're coaching at what level. So the fact that we have one of the greatest ever in Coach Auriemma and Coach Staley, who's going to be right there with him one day, is one of the greatest ever. Is even as old as I am, is still an inspiration for me.
It's well said. Hey, one more. This for Sheila. For Sheila. Yeah. Right here.
Sheila.
Henry
Sheila
Iva, Reagan. Coach of the Year, Kelvin Sampson.
Thank you.
So I don't know about you all, but growing up, I would always get a piece of advice to never strive for perfection because nobody's perfect. And I'm very glad that our next award winner didn't heed that advice if she was ever given it. It's my distinct honor to introduce Dawn Staley, who is the Coach of the Year winner this year. Let's give it up for Dawn Staley. Before I give you some of her accolades here. She and her South Carolina Gamecocks were perfect. They posted a 38-0 record on their way to the national championship, which marked Dawn Staley's third national championship. Yes. Round of applause for that. And she is no stranger to this award. She becomes the first coach in the award's history to capture the honor in three consecutive seasons, and this is her fourth award, second most all-time. Let's take a look at some of the amazing highlights from Dawn Staley's perfect national championship season. Champion, perfect record, Dawn Staley. Thank you so much for joining us, Coach. First question, you are one of the most fashionable and coolest people in sports. Did you ever get Coach Auriemma that outfit that he asked for in the video?
He actually said something to me when we played them. He said he wanted one of these outfits. I'll send it to him. He just has to wear them.
I don't know where Coach is in the audience, but I think that that's a fair deal, right? You'll wear it if she sends it to you. We'll ask him when he comes up on stage. So before we talk about your latest accomplishment, I want to go back to last season. You made the Final Four. You lose all five of your starters from that 2023 squad. And I know recently you mentioned that after that turnover, you considered retirement. Was that a fleeting thought or something you actually considered?
It wasn't actually after that moment because we had a pretty good team. It was in June when we were bringing in all of our team and they were out of shape. They were late to class. They didn't communicate. Like, they didn't respond back to text messages or phone calls. So it was almost like a change, a shift, because the 4 years prior to this season, we had just pros. We had pros. They act like pros. They formed habits like pros for 4 years. So we didn't have to deal with anything besides basketball because they took care of their business. And then this summer, they made us coach again. The other part of coaching, like, there are people that will talk about, like, fans will talk about strategy on game day. You can't be a game day coach. That's the easy part for us. It is the pre-game days that you really have to coach and get your players to a place where they can perform at a high level. So it was that. But then I switched and just switched my mind to looking at it as a challenge. And once I looked at it as a challenge, then it became kind of cool to get them to where we needed to be. To play at a high level, to create habits that we could utilize throughout a season. But it was not pretty in June.
Well, you certainly got it turned around in an epic fashion. But as you have this talent turnover and you're going through that pre-game day, as you mentioned, at what point did you look at this group and say, I think we have something pretty special here?
I actually never, because...
Never?
Yeah, no... I mean, I think we were too close to the situation because it, you know, the first game of the season we played over in Paris, we played Notre Dame, and they surprised me. Like, they really surprised me because I didn't know what team was going to take the floor, and the team that took the floor just got up and down. They played faster, they played together, and we actually beat them by a pretty good score. But I still wouldn't drink the Kool-Aid. I would not. I would sit. but I wouldn't take a big gulp. And then just, you know, game by game, they started to form some chemistry and some culture, some things that organically happened because of what they were doing, mainly off the court. I think they started hanging out with each other and just watching basketball. Like, and this was a team that really didn't watch a lot of basketball. But once they started getting better as a team, they started getting more inquisitive about what's happening out, you know, in women's basketball world. What a great year to do that, because we had access. It was all over. It was on television every night. You could stream it. You had access to our games. And I think them educating themselves on what's happening outside of their worlds, and that's big, because young people like this. They like to be in their own worlds. I think we grew from that. So, but still, you know, we did not let being undefeated guide us. It never came up in our preparation. It never came up like on a daily basis. It was just moving on to the next thing. And I really liked our team because they stayed present. They didn't look backwards. They didn't look forward. They just stayed with what we had to do in the present.
I was going to ask you about that, going into the tournament undefeated. It's such a fine line between being confident and having that bravado on what you've accomplished and not letting it get to your head as you enter a tournament like that. But it seems as if your team never really let all the outside noise and the pressure of being undefeated get to them.
It was amazing because they I said this earlier, they play free. Like free, like no pressure. And the coaches took on all the pressure. Like, you know, I was tight every game. It's like, and they're, one time I asked them during that NCAA tournament, one game, I don't know, I think it may have been against Oregon State. I said, right before they went out, I said, "Are you guys tight?" And they're like, "Tight? No." And then Camila, who, you know, she's Brazilian, she speaks Portuguese, and she was like, "Tight? What does tight mean?" I said, "Oh, never mind. Then you're not tight. If you got to ask what it means, you're good. We're good."
Well, speaking of Camila, I wanted to ask you about her. She was in the spotlight again this week. She selected to the Chicago Sky WNBA draft. Let's give it up for Camila. And I was reading about your advice that you would give her, and a quote that you had about her game is you said, "If she keeps the approach that she has, she'll be hoisting not only a championship trophy, but an MVP trophy." Tell me about Camila's game and why you have the confidence in what you've seen in her that her game is going to translate and she'll be dominate in the W.
Well, Camila's 6'7". She's incredibly mobile. She can pass. I think this year she took the jump of being the focal point of our offense and our defense. And I think sometimes it takes a little while for young people to find their greatness. And sometimes they hide behind other players. And she played behind Aaliyah Boston, who was our All-American and our National Player of the Year. And she got comfortable in that role. And then once Aaliyah left, it was her turn to step into that role. And I thought she was hesitant at first. And then you have to kind of force them to go out there and say, "Hey, you know, you got to put a little pressure on them." And she handled the pressure well. Like, she would not let our team lose in the NCAA tournament. One, it's probably because she had a mind made up that she was going to leave us, and she wanted to leave her teammates on a high note. But she took that next step of shouldering our basketball team. You need somebody that is willing to take on the responsibility of, you know, not only you put the ball in their hands and they go get a bucket. They make a good decision to pass it out. They make a good decision to, you know, utilize, you know, their high field goal percentage. And that, you know, sometimes she was passing out through it from a double team to somebody that shoots 40%. Well, she shoots 60. Force your way in there, split the double, and go score. And rely on your 60% field goal percentage. So it was that process of learning how to be the focal point.
Well, somebody who is stepping into that role, Malaysia Fulwiley, how good is she?
She's really good.
Like, she's really good.
She really is good. Like, I mean, I like Malaysia because she wants to be great. Like, she really does. And she's great, the coach, because she's serious. Like, she's I'll give you an example. Very early on, she shot like a 40-foot three-point shot. She missed it. So one of our point guard, Tahina Pau Pau, said, "Hey, Lay, you know, I can get you an easy one, an easier one, right?" And she under her breath, she said, "But I can make that," right? Both things are true. She can make it. Pau saying, "I can get you an easy one," they're true. So I actually use it as a teaching moment to let them know that they're both right. But a 40-foot three, we can get you an easier look. Like, we can, but you can make it. Like, we've seen her make it. But it was those kind of moments in which she had to learn. Like, I had to sit her very early on in our we played North Carolina, at North Carolina. And we put her in a game, and defensively, she was just lost. In transition, she was lost. Half court, you know, she was sleeping on the weak side of the floor. So it was one, two, three opportunities we gave her to correct it so she wouldn't correct it. So we took her out and we never put her back in. So, you know, she started crying probably during the game and after the game. And then I get a text message from her mother, right? Let me get y'all this. This is real life. Like, this is coaching. This is not game day coaching. It's post-game coaching. And her mother was basically upset, you know, with me because she didn't play. She didn't get an opportunity. And I was telling her she did. She got three opportunities that she did. So now I'm going to give y'all this. So I told the mother that, and she's a young mother. Like, she's much younger than me. So she gives me the thumbs down on the text message again.
Oh, boy.
I'm like, hold up. Like, hold up. I was like, we can talk. Like, we can talk. I just can't do the, I can't. But it is, you know, when you have a generational talent, parents haven't seen their children not play. They were able to play through everything in high school because they're the best player. So we talked. I mean, I talked her off the ledge and said, "Say, I have her. She's still a generational talent. Let's not forget about that. But there's some things that you have to learn." And then by the end of the conversation, she was like, "I trust you, coach. I trust you." And it is that kind of thing that you have to have conversations with parents. You got to take them through this journey because it's hard. And the way that our sport is set up, everybody's good. Everybody doesn't have a great day every day. And if you got other players that can get it done, that's the best teacher in that iron sharpens iron. She's never been the same after that moment. She became a much better defensive player on ball, not off ball, on ball. And then you teach the parents how to navigate. So she was the freshman she made all freshman team in the SEC. She's making a lot of NIL money. So a mom probably doesn't remember that conversation. I'm good with that.
Well, let's go from a thumbs down to a thumbs up. A couple more things for you, coach. When you are celebrating your big accomplishment, winning the national championship, I thought it was so gracious of you to take part of that in your moment and shout out Caitlin Clark for everything that she's done so far this season and in her career and for women's college basketball. For our audience here, as you observed her this year, how has she changed the game?
Oh, I mean, viewership. I mean, she's got more eyeballs on our sport, like single-handedly. And I'm all for raising our sport as a whole and giving credit where credit is due. Any game that she played in, you know, the ratings and the viewership outdid itself. So, and she was the common denominator in all of those games. And you have to give credit where credit is due. Here's the thing. Decision makers of our game decided that she should play on in prime time, right? They did their part. Now we got to see Juju in prime time now.
Yep. That's right.
We got to see Juju in prime time now. We know that it can get done. You just got to push us out there and make the decision to put our best players on television. And, you know, they're going to be put to the test next year because Caitlin will be in the WNBA, but there's some residuals. There's some great young talent out here that needs to be seen and great programs that need to be put on television, and all the stories of our game need to be told.
Absolutely, and I can't wait to continue to watch Juju shine on the national stage. Two more quick things for you, Coach. I have to ask you this because Coach Hinson mentioned it, and on my national show on ESPN, when it was announced that John Calipari would no longer be at Kentucky, and a lot of people were talking about different names and coaches that could replace him, your name was brought up a lot. Is that something that you would ever consider, making the jump from the women's game to the men's game?
No. I mean, my passion is young people, young girls that look like me, young ladies, you know, that grew up in the game like I grew up in the game. And that has been my passion. I've never wanted to coach in the WNBA. I've never wanted to coach in the NBA. I've never wanted to coach men's basketball. My passion is where I am, and I'm going to see it through. My name may have been in some of those conversations, but no ADs or general managers called me.
That surprises me that no one called you. Okay, last thing for you before we bring up USBWA President Malcolm Moran. If you can hang tight, we're going to bring him up in a second because he has something he wants to share with us. I was speaking with him earlier about you, and he brought up an interesting question that I would love to ask you now. As Dawn Staley, the coach, incredibly accomplished, how would Dawn Staley, the coach, have handled Dawn Staley, the player?
I mean, me 24 years ago and me today is a lot different. Me today, I'm probably a lot more mature. But I would meet Dawn Staley where she was. Like I can see like a little bit of me in Malaysia Fuwale. So I meet her where she is, no matter, and it fluctuates every day. It's something different. So I would handle that with care to balance, you know, coaching her and pointing out things that she needs to improve in, and then lifting her up and things that she's doing extremely well. Just creating that balance, because it's a fine line to keep young people incredibly confident, but yet in a position of always learning about themselves and learning about the game, so, you know, so they can continue to, you know, do some spectacular things and keep the viewership going and keep the eyeballs on our game.
Great answer, and that's why you have so much success. So, Coach, if you could stay here for a second, I know Malcolm Moran from the USBWA wants to come up and share something with you.
Thanks, Michelle, and thanks, Dawn, for the perfect segue for what I'm here for. Dawn might not remember this because I was just part of the blur, but more than 32 years ago, when one of us was young and the other was working for the New York Times, we met in Charlottesville when I wrote a story about the returning USBWA National Player of the Year. Dawn was taking on a challenge that I've seen a lot of students face, learning how to channel their passion, develop an understanding of those around her and how they work, and finding the best ways to motivate them. I learned that she treated younger teammates differently than older ones. And she explained, we all have gone through that stage where we just don't know what to do next. I learned about something that had happened about a month earlier, prior to my visit, when a 16-year-old girl in crisis climbed to the top of a parking garage downtown and threatened to jump. The police, in search of any way to engage, discovered that the girl was willing to talk about basketball. A phone call was made, and for a while, Dawn was the only person that was allowed to go into the sealed-off area. The words that she shared remained private, but remember what she had said, the reality that she already understood? We have all gone through that stage where we just don't know what to do next. In the 35 years the USBWA has named a Women's National Coach of the Year, Dawn is the first to win the award 4 times in 5 seasons. But as a Hall of Fame coaching career has unfolded, I just said it, she has been doing a lot more than winning games. She has been unafraid to engage with people that needed someone or something. She has fiercely defended the underrepresented, especially children. Among her many commitments, nearly 11 years ago, she created Inner Soul, an initiative that provides new sneakers to children that are homeless or in need. This is real life. In 2015, the USBWA announced the creation of the Dean Smith Award to honor the legacy of Coach Smith and his use of the platform to become an agent for positive change. Tomorrow, the USBWA will announce the creation of the C. Vivian Stringer Award, similarly honoring the former coach at Cheney State, Iowa, and Rutgers for the way she has used the game as a vehicle to change the lives of people around her and even those she never knew. It is my great honor to share with all of you here tonight that the announcement will include the news that the recipient of the inaugural C. Vivian Stringer Award, to be presented later this year at a time and place of her choosing from the University of South Carolina, is Dawn Staley.
Congratulations, Coach. Another incredible honor. Just what are your emotions after hearing that?
Coach Stringer has been someone that still calls me to this day. She is the reason why I sit where I sit. I do think we stand on the shoulders of a woman that has been through everything and has succeeded. A black woman that's been through everything and succeeded. And she actually has given us the blueprint to be able to be as successful as we are, the pit roads that come with it. So I am truly honored and I'm caught off guard, but I'm flattered. I am. And you all gonna make me call her tomorrow. Like I'm gonna fast forward my monthly call and make it tomorrow, just to say that I'm honored to be the first, and hopefully it's a long list of coaches that will shed the light of the being the voice for the voiceless and standing up for things that they strongly are passionate about. So thank you so much.
Everyone, let's give it up one more time for the incredible National Coach of the Year, Dawn Staley. Thank you so much, Coach.
And now for a little more history. 10 days into his presidency of the USBWA, 45 years after the great Dave Doerr of the Post-Dispatch served in the same capacity, please welcome Stu Duranda.
Thank you. Something. I am here tonight to introduce our next interviewee, Gino Auriemma. It was an honor to be asked to introduce Gino. It isn't often, you know, his accomplishments, obviously everyone knows them, they've heard them. It isn't often that you have someone who's inducted into two major halls of fame, Naismith basketball and the women's basketball, and 18 years later, they're still at the top of their game. His accomplishments, achievements have been repeated, but now that they're updated after another trip to the Final Four, I'll recite a few of them. Gino has 1,213 wins. He has coached 6 undefeated teams, 11 national championships, which is unmatched. He has taken UConn to the Final Four 23 times. This could go on for a while, but I'll try and cut him short. 30 years in a row in the Sweet 16. 8 times he's been named the Naismith Coach of the Year, and on and on and on. You get the point. He's coached players such as Rebecca Lobo, Diana Taurasi, Sue Bird, Maya Moore, Brianna Stewart, Nafisa Collier, who played high school basketball here in St. Louis. And now Paige Beckers, so it continues, the great players going through his program. A lot of time has been spent this season and tonight talking about this boom in women's college basketball, as it should be. But, you know, Gino's been plugging away at this thing for 4 decades. Highly successful for 3. I don't remember what happened the first decade. And without people like Gino Auriemma, Pat Summitt, Dawn Staley as trailblazers, we wouldn't be at the point we are today with the growth of the game. It was announced today that upon his retirement, whenever that might be, the Women's Coach of the Year Award will be in Gino Auriemma's name. Thus, he will never win his own award, but he will hopefully be able to hand it out to somebody on this stage moving forward, whether that be 3, 5, or 7. Maybe he'll tell us tonight when he plans to retire. So I introduce Gino Auriemma.
So the USBWA is going to name the Women's Coach of the Year Award for Gino Auriemma. When I say that sentence, how do you feel?
You said I got the Naismith Coach of the Year Award 8 times?
8 times.
But only 6 from these guys. So you're trying to make up for it by naming an award after me. When I got the phone call from Malcolm, the text preceded it, and it was, "It's really good news, so call me back." And I assumed that it was, you know, one of your players made first team All-American or something to that nature. And I was actually quite speechless when he brought it up, because this is not something that, while you're still actively coaching, you get to hear these kinds of things, and something that you never contemplated. And I have tremendous respect for coaches. You know, I could never, even to this day, like, I could never call my high school coach by his first name.
Really?
Yeah. You know, it's always been, for me, coach. When I came over from Italy as a little kid, sports was what allowed me to become like a little American kid. And the most influential people in my life were my my coaches from the time I was, 9 years old, 10 years old. And I've had the utmost respect for anyone who coaches anywhere at any level. And even today, when I'm places and I run into, you know, old coaches like Roy and Kelvin, and I'm older than Kelvin, which really sucks that he said he's old. I have a hard time because I have such a reverence for coaches, and to be put in this situation is incredibly humbling for me.
So you mentioned when you were young and you came from Italy and you're here in America, what would little Gino think about this moment in your life right now that you would not only be coaching basketball, but you would be so great at it so consistently that the USBWA is naming the award for you?
I always wanted to play the game, especially baseball. You know, like I was a baseball player. I wasn't really, I played basketball because there was nothing, I couldn't play baseball in the wintertime, right? So I played baseball, and I always wanted to play baseball the way a coach would play baseball. And I wanted to play, there was part of me that wanted to play a different position all nine innings, because I wanted to experience everything there was to experience about the game. And I never wanted to be that kid playing right field. You know, where you go out there for 3 hours and nobody ever hits a ball to you, nothing ever happens. You know, and you go, luckily my parents didn't speak English. They never came to a game. So you could come home and go, how was the game? Great, we won. I was 4 for 4. I had 3 home runs, you know. So I always wanted to act like a coach without being a coach. I just wanted to study the game, study it, learn more about it. And I've always been like that. You know, I think when you don't speak the language, the way you learn is you pay attention. You look and see what other people do, right? So when somebody is telling you something and you don't understand what they're saying, you're just looking at the person in front of you, and then you do what they did, because you figure if they didn't get yelled at, they must have done the right thing. So whenever we're doing drills and you got a kid who's like fourth or fifth in line and they get it wrong, they, you know, everybody goes left and this kid shows up and they go right, then you know, like, they can't play. They got to be the dumbest human being in the world. Like, all you have to do is stand there, pay attention to the person in front of you. So I learned by watching, by paying attention, by listening. And I think I coach that way. I try to teach my players to pay attention, learn, listen, observe, be cognizant of people around you and what they're doing. Always be aware, you know, of what your surroundings are. And I learned all that from my coaches. And I never wanted to be a coach. I had no interest whatsoever in coaching. And I was talked into it, and I kept saying, no, 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 I want no part of it. And I only did it as a favor to a friend of mine. And then I got stuck doing it, and here I am.
I hope you sent that friend a fruit basket or something, because he pushed you down the right path.
Yeah, no, he became a great coach in his own right. Jim Foster, who coached at Vanderbilt and in the SEC, and then he's retired now. But, you know, life takes you places, and here I am. That's it.
Here you are. So we mentioned some of the accolades, 11 national championship, 8-time coach of the year. It's hard enough to have success once. How difficult is it to maintain success?
I happened to be at the men's Final Four last year because our team was in it, meaning our men's team was in it. And I remember talking to Danny Hurley the night before the game. And I said, whatever happens tomorrow, your life is screwed. I said, you will never be the same after tomorrow. If you win, your obsession with winning another one is going to ruin your life. If you lose, your obsession to get back here is going to ruin your life. I said, so once you win something like a national championship, the burning desire to do it again is overwhelming. And you almost have to, it's almost like you have to, like golf, you know, like you have to get a par or a birdie on the next hole. Like, you have to win another one to prove that it wasn't like a fluke, you know. And, you know, luckily I'm surrounded by you know, coaches that have won multiple national championships, so they know what I'm talking about. But the obsession to win, and not after the second one, not for you anymore, but because you feel like you owe it to your players to let them experience that same feeling that only winning a championship can feel like. And that ends up being what drives you. But in the beginning, you're just obsessed with, you know, we have to win a national championship and then we have to do it again. And now that we won 11 and we haven't won one since 2016, and people are, you know, like I'm day to day at UConn, you know, you set a standard where winning a national championship is the only thing that's acceptable.
Well, speaking of Danny Hurley, he got it done again this season. Storrs, Connecticut is the epicenter, seemingly, of college basketball. South Carolina as well. A lot of great programs. But at UConn, do these two programs feed off one another, the women's and the men's teams?
I think so. I think there's a level of competition. You know, sometimes the teams don't interact that much for whatever reason. You know, we have one practice facility with two separate courts, but in the middle, there's the weight room, training room. So we're around those guys all the time, and we have to share the same dining room. So we're around those players all the time. And there is a level of respect that you want them to win and they want you to win. And, you know, we've won 17 national championships at the University of Connecticut. Our men have won more national championships since 2000 than any other school in America. And yet, you know, there's always this question, well, they are blue blood, are they North Carolina, are they Duke, are they Kentucky? You know, we've won more national championships in the last 25 years than all those schools combined, maybe. So there's this feeling like we're the little guys, we're the underdog, we're always trying to prove ourselves. And that runs through the entire building. You know, when you walk in the building at UConn, you just know that this is the goal, and we don't even talk about it. Like Dawn said, you don't talk about winning. You just know it's implied. If you come to work here, you're coming to win a championship, and that's all there is to it.
There's so many exciting stars right now in college basketball, particularly on the women's side. One of them, Paige Beckers, she announced that she's coming back to UConn for the 24-25 season, which I'm sure thrilled you. What was your reaction when you heard she was coming back?
I kind of knew, but I wasn't, you know, you're never sure today, you know, young people, you're not quite sure. But she did tell me at one point, I came to UConn to play for 4 years. And her freshman year, we went to the Final Four. Her sophomore year, we lost in the national championship game to these guys. Her junior year, she missed the whole year with an injury. And, this year we were in the Final Four. So she feels like in her mind, I owe Coach one more year, one more shot at it, and let's see what we can do. So she's a very prideful kid. She's got a great, great way about her. She's a tremendous teammate. And she loves being part of what we do. So I wasn't surprised. I'm happy she announced it the way she did, but... and listen, don't get me wrong. These people are not easy to coach. You know, I don't know if you know, like these coaches will tell you, you know, just because these guys are unbelievably talented and they're gifted and this and all that, they are not easy to coach at all because they're driven. They're tough. They're stubborn. They think they know more than you do. They want to be right all the time. And that's a real problem when you're coaching kids that want to be right all the time when you know that you're right all the time.
Exactly.
You know, it's a battle. It's a battle every day.
Two more things for you, Coach. You said sometimes these players are not easy to coach, but they're certainly easy to watch.
Yeah.
You have been in this profession for a long time, and there's been great teams and exciting stars in the women's game, but we have seen this explosion in popularity recently. What do you think it is about this crop of young women and the game right now that is attracting so many eyeballs to your product?
You know, we were talking about this earlier upstairs. There was a lot of great basketball played before this season, but the attention wasn't on the game like it was this year. And that might be because somebody like Caitlin Clark, like, she does things that most other players wouldn't dare to do. You know, they just wouldn't take some of the shots she takes. They just wouldn't, you know, go about it the way she goes about it. And she happened to do it at a time when everybody was forced to watch. All right, well, we're going to put these games on, like Dawn said. All right, well, now that we put them on, what are we watching? Well, they ended up getting to watch somebody do crazy stuff, like where she shoots from. And every guy that used to think, I can beat any girl in a game of one-on-one. No, you couldn't. I mean, Reed's father could, but no, you couldn't. So now she's making shots from a place you never made a shot in your life. So all of a sudden, people started to go, wow, that's unbelievable. And then, you know, kids like Juju come along, and it's like she plays completely different than Caitlin. But it's just as exciting to watch, and hell, harder than to play, to coach against, to be honest with you. But there's so many young players right now that are playing the game in a way that is fun to watch. And people are being forced to watch because it's compelling. And it's time. And I'll give you another example. Like on the men's side, one of the things that used to be so great on the men's side, and I was at UVA for 4 years as an assistant coach, and I remember Coach Williams over there, and I remember when UVA played North Carolina, and North Carolina had that championship team, and they had Worthy, Perkins, Michael Jordan, Jimmy Black, and Matt Daugherty, right, Coach? Yeah. And Matt Daugherty. And they won national championship, and UVA was number one in the country. And we had one great player. We had Ralph Sampson. But there was this incredible dynamic of you got to see these players freshman year, sophomore year, junior year. You grew up with them. They build a brand at their school. They created a fan base across America. And it just exploded. And then things change. Kids now go to college on the men's side. They play 1 year and they leave. They play 2 years, they leave. The transfer portal. 1 year they're at your school. Next year they're at your school. The third year they're at your school. So the men, but no fault of the kids, don't get me wrong, have lost the thing that made them what they were. And I think the women, they have that. So they've kind of replaced what the men used to have. Let's just hope we can keep it going.
Yes. We're emotionally invested in them. We are. We're emotionally invested in their journeys.
Yeah, and you got 18 million people watching the game. I think, you know, our games are on Fox. The Big East has a contract with Fox. And, you know, we have a meeting with Fox coming up. And all they want to talk about is how many primetime games they want to do. Because I think, you know, they're not stupid. You know, they'll put on, you know, they'll put on two people mud wrestling if they think 18 million people are going to watch.
That's right.
So if you got this product and you got these kids that are this accomplished and this good, and 18 million people are going to watch, you're going to see whatever you saw this year, you're going to see a lot more of it next year, even more than you saw this year.
Last thing for you, Coach. So many people in this room are leaders. They're leaders at work. They're leaders at home. They're leaders in their community. As somebody who's been an incredible leader for a long period of time through different circumstances and obstacles, if you could give everyone in this room one piece of advice on how to be a great leader, what would it be?
Get great followers. That sounds stupid, right? But I mean, tell me a leader who didn't have great followers. So, well, how did he have great followers or she have great followers? Well, you get people that want to follow, that want to be led, that want to buy into what you are already giving them. And then you find out from them, okay, I know you want something. I know you are desperate for something. I know you're in need of some direction. Tell me how I can direct you. Tell me how I can lead you. Tell me how I can take you from where you are right now to where you want to go. Because obviously you don't know how to get there by yourself. Because if you did, you wouldn't need me. So obviously I've got someone who says, Coach, take me from where I am to where I want to be. All right, I can do that. If you got to drag that guy or that woman kicking and screaming, fighting you all the time, nobody can be a leader in those circumstances. So first you recruit the kind of people that want to be led to a place where you've all agreed you want to go. And then you keep asking them and you keep listening to what they have to say. And then you do the best that you can to service them in the best way that you can.
Incredible advice. Thank you so much, Coach. Everyone, please put your hands together again for Gino Auriemma.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm gonna love you.
Ladies and gentlemen, from one legend to another, let's direct your attention to the video screen for our final guest of the evening.
Coach Roy Williams and the North Carolina Tar Heels.
North Carolina is the 2009 national champion.
For the rest of my life, I'll always say that I was a coach, and that's the proudest moment of my life. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, 33 seasons, 903 wins, 19 Sweet 16s, 13 Elite Eights, 9 Final Fours, 3 National Championships, Hall of Famer Roy Williams.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is pretty cool. So we get to close this out by talking some ball. But first, what a night. I mean, to have all of these great people and names, what do you think about tonight?
I've got a great idea. I really do. I was thinking as this is going on, because this is a long night. We're all coaches. We talk a lot. I'm worse than anybody except Bill Walton. But... But I did think what you could do is everybody in here that supports the program, you could get a cardboard figure of yourself and come and set your cardboard figure down and then leave and have Bill Walton and Barry Henson. And so they'll talk for 2 hours. But you will need two microphones because Bill's going to go like this and Barry will never get to talk with a microphone. So... But this is, being honest, I'm extremely flattered. This is one of the nicest things I've ever been involved with. Some of my heroes, my contemporaries that I really do believe are heroes of mine, being tonight with Don and Kelvin and Gino up and downstairs when we first started. This is a really neat event. The food was sensational. And that piece of meat, it reminded me of what Kansas, Missouri beef is like. So that was that's pretty good. And so for me, it's been a sensational night, one that I've really enjoyed. It got started off in a terrible thing. I had I was supposed to get here 3 hours earlier than I did because of flight problems and agent problems and all kinds of things, but I'm as happy as I can be to be here. I'm happy to be able to sit with Ryan Robertson, played for us at Kansas, and one of my heroes right there. And I still remember when I was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 2007, I apologized to the 97 Kansas team because it was one of the best teams I ever coached and maybe the best. But I didn't get those guys to the Final Four. And that is still I'm 73 years old. By the way, Gino, I agree with you. Kelvin pisses me off. Where's Kelvin? Kelvin's talking about, I'm 5 years older than Kelvin is. But that 97 team that I had at Kansas was a great team, and that's still a void that I couldn't get those guys, didn't get those guys. Jared Hess, got hurt for us in 97, but Ryan Robertson was fantastic for us, a St. Louis guy. So I've had a great time and brought back a lot of great memories.
Do you think about that a lot then? You think about that?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, at times like this when you're being honored and, you know, I didn't know what an honoree was going to do, you know, when I was contacted to do this. And I thought, geez, this is pretty good. And I asked Wanda if she wanted to come. And she said no. And I told her Barry Henson was talking. And she said, between you and Barry, I know I don't want to be there. So so it was a neat deal. But she's getting some things ready for this weekend with our grandchildren.
Big KMOX guy, by the way, when you were recruiting, driving around as the coach at Kansas, you told me you listened to our radio station. You were connected to St. Louis back then.
When I was a high school student, I had an old radio that my uncle had given us. It was 150 years old. It was probably the first radio ever invented. But it was amazing that I could get stations all over the country. And I was in Asheville, North Carolina, listening to KMOX baseball and basketball games. And so coming to St. Louis and recruiting and St. Louis, and Detroit, Michigan, and Phoenix, Arizona, my three favorite cities in the whole United States. But St. Louis in this area has been very special to me.
Absolutely. Won the national championship across the street at the Dome. Where are our North Carolina fans in here?
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank
you. Unbelievable weekend for St. Louis and especially for you. Take me back to 2005.
Well, it was an incredible year. My first year at North Carolina, coaches do crazy things, and I made some T-shirts out, play hard, play smart, play in March, because nobody on my team had ever been in the NCAA tournament because North Carolina hadn't played in the tournament 2 years in a row, and so all those guys on the team had never played in a tournament. And we did okay. We made it to the tournament. And I promised them, I said, play your tail off and let's get better. We'll make the tournament. We'll do some good things. And then I'll get you some help. And next year we'll have a chance to win the whole blessed thing. And I got Marvin Williams and Quentin Thomas to come. And Rashad and Raymond and Jawad and Sean and Jackie, everybody got better. And so we were having a really good year, and the farther we went, we got a little more confident. And then the weekend, I said this earlier today, the weekend of the Final Four, play the semifinal games, and we win. And there was a headline in the paper, talent versus team. And it really ticked me off. And I made sure it pissed my team off because I showed it to them. I gave every single player a copy of it. And because the implication was we had talent, but that Illinois was the better team. And that was a great help to us. I mean, you don't think that you have to look for things to motivate when you're playing in a national championship game. But that was important to us. But I built it up that was an insult. And, you know, we had some wayward individuals at times that particularly before I got there. But that was something that was a big help. And we had Sean May. And Sean May's birthday was the day of the national championship game. And I remember at breakfast that morning, I said something about this would be a great birthday present. I said, but it's your choice to give the birthday present to me. You got to play your butt off. But so we did, and it was a fantastic Illinois team. But we played really well. That night, we were better than they were. That's not to say that we were better the whole time, but coming today, I got here, as I said, much later, and I wanted to, but I went and walked around the dome and just remembered coming in to the arena and playing the semifinals, coming in to the night of the championship game, and Sean May telling everybody at the press conference that he wanted to be the first player to hug me when Coach Williams wins his first national championship. And so those kind of things I thought about today, and I remember getting on the bus and going back to the Adams Mark. I walked over there today, and I couldn't find the Adams Mark.
It's so, changed, yeah.
But I know it's the building's still there. But it was a great, great experience, and it's this coming season will be the 20th anniversary of that championship.
Wow, that's amazing. And you won three of them with North Carolina. You won in Detroit, as you mentioned, and you won in Phoenix. Coach, I got to think that 2017 was incredible. They all are. But that 2017 had to have been incredibly special, considering that you were that close the year before and you came back and won it.
Yeah, in 2016, we in the championship game against Villanova. We were 10 down with like 4 minutes to play, and Marcus Page made the most difficult shot I've ever seen any individual make under those circumstances, a three to tie the game with 4 or 5 seconds left. And in fact, I told Michael Jordan that if we had gotten that game into overtime and won it, his shot to beat Georgetown would have been the second most famous shot ever at North Carolina. He said, I don't know about that, but I said... But I told him that I knew about that because it was going to be something. But it was the hardest thing I've ever done. And with Gino and Don and Kelvin and the other coaches, you know, I'm old. I'm so old. I saw Bob Sunvo in here. Where's Bobby? I remember when Bob was young, so I'm really old, you know, that guy. But for us, it was the worst moment in my coaching career, other than not helping the 97 team get there, because what do you say to your team when they make a shot at the buzzer to win the national championship? And I'll never forget that I'm sitting in a little holding area, and I couldn't go into the team. I felt completely inadequate. And all of a sudden, somebody comes and wraps me up in a big bear hug, and it was Michael. And I said, Michael, will you do me a favor? Will you just go in there and tell them you're proud of them? Because I don't know what to say. And he said yes. And the funny thing later on, it became funny because Marcus Page is in the locker room and this voice is talking. And all of a sudden it dawns on him, that's not Coach Williams. And he's got his head in a towel and he's crying in the towel. And he told me this story later, and that he took the towel down and, oh my gosh, it's Michael Jordan. And so I said that night, the most difficult thing for me was Marcus, Bryce, and Joel James, because they were seniors and they were not going to get a chance for a do-over. Gino and Kelvin and I played golf, and you know, you don't get a mulligan in NCAA tournament. You don't get to go back. And so we lost those three guys, but I challenged everybody else to use that as fuel to work harder over the summer to get back. And it was crazy because I'm old school. And so the next year, first day of practice, I allowed them to mic me. It's the only time I've ever done that in my life. And so at the huddle, I blew the whistle and everybody runs up to the center line. And I looked around like I'm looking at you guys. I said, right here in front of me is a team that's good enough to be the last team standing on Monday night in Phoenix. And the players just looked right down deep into my soul. And we play well and get things going, and we win the national championship. And at the basketball banquet that year, they played the tape. And I'd never seen it, and I'd forgotten all about it. And, you know, I'm 67 years old at that time, like baby Kelvin, 69. Jesus Christ. I'll be 74 in August. God almighty. Between Kelvin Sampson and Bob Sunvo, I'm really freaking old. But they played that video, and I got really emotional because I'd forgotten all about it. But those kids did use that as fuel, and redemption was their motto. And I didn't ever hear that word until the Final Four in 17. But it was a fun time.
Wow. Well, just a few things I wanted to hit on. What was Dean Smith like in those moments? You worked alongside him for a long time.
Well, Coach, like we were talking, and I think it was somebody, I apologize, I'm 73 years old, Kel. Somebody said, I think it was Gino, said he never called his high school coach by his first name. Is that right, Gino? I never called Coach Smith anything but Coach Smith. If somebody says, Roy said Dean did this, that guy's lying, because I never called him Dean my entire life, and partner on the golf course and do everything. But I thought he was the best coach I ever saw. He was meticulous. He was prepared for everything. We practiced late game situations every day. When we came from 8 down with 17 seconds to go and no 3-point shot and tied the game and beat Duke in overtime, all those players on that team, because that was, this year was the 50th year of anniversary of that, and every one of them talked about, I was in the stands. It was my first year as a high school coach. It was the only game I saw that year. But every player talked about that Coach Smith said, all right, we're 8 down. Bobby's going to knock these 2 free throws in, and we're going to go 44 all over, and we'll steal the first one, and we'll lay it up and cut it to 4, and then we'll call timeout, and they'll be a little worried. And that's what happened. Bobby made the free throws. We steal the ball. They lay it up and call timeout. And now at the timeout, he says, all right, we're down 4. Let's see if we can get another turnover. And if we do get it, let's get it to the basket, take it to the basket, score, and call a timeout. And that's what we did. And then he said, if we don't get a steal, let's foul, and it'll be hard for them to make this free throw. And so we fouled, and the young man goes, I know his name just like I do my own, but I'm not saying it. But he goes to the free throw line and misses, and we get to rebound and call timeout. And that's the reason Coach Smith always kept his timeouts, and I did too. All the Carolina fans, I got many letters telling me that I was wrong, thinking God was going to give me special privileges because I didn't call timeouts. Okay. But I was saving. What's that? We did play defense, if that's what you said. But if you didn't say that, I don't know what the hell you did say. So we're all right. But everybody'd say, why didn't you call a timeout? And I mean, I really was. One night we were down 18 to nothing. I didn't call out. I was down 15 to nothing. Didn't call a timeout. 13 to nothing. 12 to nothing. And we came back and won all those games. And at the end, I just did it just to make the fans mad and the media mad. But Coach Smith choreographed that thing, so he was the best I've ever seen on the court, and he was far superior off the court with his relationships. And as Kelvin talking about having the 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A high school coaches speak at the clinic and those kind of things, that he did more things for people without them ever knowing about it. Most of the time, if you do something for Tom, you try to make sure he knows that you did it, you know, that. But Coach Smith did more things for people. So he was an incredible mentor and an incredible friend and incredible for the game of basketball. And I was the luckiest person in the world to work for him for 10 years.
And I know that's what gave you some peace to go to North Carolina from Kansas, because you had that pull, because you're from Asheville, North Carolina. I wanted to ask you about your time at Kansas, though, in that incredible building, Allen Fieldhouse, playing at Hearn Center. Your battles with Mizzou, specifically for this audience, for we grew up on the Big 8. What do you remember from those?
That during the game, Norm Stewart, I didn't like him at all. Away from the game, I really liked him. We had good times, and what he did with the coaches versus cancer thing is just overwhelming. The first 4 times we played, Missouri beat us all 4 times. So my first 2 years, they were 4-0. All Missouri fans, give yourself a hand. That's all right. Okay. And the next 3 years, we beat their ass 6 in a row. So, but we had some great battles, and Ryan, I remember Ryan Sr. wanted so badly to win at in Columbia, and it was a great win for us. And in 94, they went 14-0 in the league, which the first time had been done. And my next to last year, I guess it was, we went undefeated in the league. And all the write-ups in Columbia was that they were going to stop the streak, and we went into Columbia and beat them the last game in the regular season to be undefeated in the league. So we had some great, great battles, and it was something that I really did enjoy. But you think about the Big 8 and the Big 12. When I got there, you got Norm Stewart, you got Billy Tubbs, you got Johnny Orr. I mean, it was 1 year to the conference meeting, and Kelvin may have even been there at this time too. Norm Stewart and Billy Tubbs got into an argument during the conference meetings. And John Erickson was our supervisor of officials. And again, Kelvin may remember this. They started cursing each other. One of them on one end of the table. John Erickson came as a supervisor of officials after being the executive director of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And I'm sitting beside Johnny Orr, and Johnny's just elbowing me, isn't this great? And I whispered, but look at John. And John Erickson, I don't know what a dead man looks like who's alive, but that's what John Erickson was. So we had some great battles, and Kelvin and I had some great battles at Oklahoma. But Kansas, Allen Fieldhouse was the best place to ever coach and play college basketball.
Great place. And I actually want to wrap with this because I love college basketball, and I know you do too, Coach. I know you love it. And college basketball, to me, is at its best when it's played at those home arenas, Allen Fieldhouse, etc. And one of the things I always respected about you, and I don't see it as much around college basketball today, is that you took your teams into the teeth of some tough places on the road. You did it for kids. You did it for your kids. You let them play in their hometown, Cedar Falls, St. Louis, et cetera, on and on. Tell me about that and what was behind that.
Well, I told them in recruiting that if you come, you figure out a place that you want to play a home game, and we'll come back to that place. And with Ryan being from St. Louis, we came to Missouri every year anyway. But Tyler Hansbrough in Poplar Bluff, and The guys on the radio station like this afternoon, and then I'll shut up. Okay, everybody's ready to go home. So I'm here in St. Louis. I'm playing golf. I played 36 with Mickey Bell, who was a former North Carolina player, and jump in the car after we had dinner, and I don't drink, but it was late. And so I'm going down to Poplar Bluff. I'm going to meet with Tyler Hansbrough and his mom and dad the next morning at 8 o'clock for the first time. And I'm going too fast. And I go over a hill, and a patrolman's coming this way, and I just pulled off the side of the road. And sure enough, he wheeled around, and he came back and got me, and he was not a happy person. And he said, "You're really speeding." And I said, "Yes, sir, I got nothing to say. I apologize. I'm trying to get to Poplar Bluff before I get sleepy, and the quickest way to get there is to go fast." And so I've got to do that, but I understand I'm wrong. I understand. So he goes back to his car, and he comes back, and he had written the ticket. And some of you guys will really like this, and some of you may have heard it. I apologize. But he hands me the ticket and said, "You shouldn't have beaten my Missouri Tigers so damn many times." I'll never hit another golf ball if that's a lie, okay? All right, so he gives me the ticket and get in the car. He goes back, and I pull out and take off. And, I was mad at myself because I told every player, high school, college, do not pull on the tiger's tail while your head's in his mouth. And if a patrolman stops you, be nice, apologize, do anything you can, be nice. And here I am. I made the guy mad because all of a sudden I look in my rearview mirror and the blue light's flashing again. I'd gone 500 yards. So I pulled over. He pulls over again, and I'm so mad at myself. I shouldn't have said anything. Just take your punishment and shut up. And he walks up to the car, and he hands me my car rental papers. He had forgotten to give it back to me. But so that was with Tyler Hansbrough, a guy from Poplar Bluff. And in my mind, the three athletes that I admired, some of them I got to work with more than anybody, is Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, and Tyler Hansbrough. Those three guys were the most focused, the most driven anybody I've ever seen. They were going to do everything they could. Tyler Hansbrough, I pull in the parking lot one morning, and he's getting out of his car, and he's got a milk jug, a gallon milk jug. And it's liquid, it's clear. I said, what are you doing? And our trainer told him you need to drink a gallon of water every day. He carried it to class with him for like 6 weeks every day and drank a gallon of water every day just there, much less what he drank in practice. So Tiger and Michael and Tyler Hansbrough were the most focused, driven, and they wanted to win. Because Tyler Hansbrough's junior, he was National Player of the Year in every honor. And I told him, you need to go to the NBA. And I don't like to say stock because that means there are horses or cows, but you have to use that term. Now, your stock is never going to be higher. And he said, Coach, I want to try to win a national championship. And I said, but Tyler, he said, don't you want to coach me? I said, no, I'd like to do that again. But he came back to North Carolina, and then Ellington came back, Ty Lawson came back, and Danny Green came back, and we were the only team that was ever unanimous preseason number one, unanimous choice that ended up winning a national championship. So those guys, yeah, that's fantastic.
One of the greatest coaches in the history of the game, Roy Williams.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Kelvin, Don, Gino, it was a pleasure being here with you guys tonight, too.
Folks, thanks very much. Have a great night. Thank you to the USBWA. We'll see you next year. Appreciate it.